Welcome to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Crystal Starr. This show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today, we hear from Anita Rodriguez. As a young woman, Rodriguez took a tape recorder and a camera into the villages of northern New Mexico and absorbed and learned the technology Ñerando. Ñeradoras are New Mexico women who are traditionally builders and carriers of a specific architectural knowledge. These women shared their knowledge with Rodriguez, who then went on to spend 25 years practicing Ñerando as a professional adobe finisher. At 47 years old, she retired her contractor's license and became a full-time painter. In 1996, she moved to Guanajuato, Mexico, and lived there for 15 years. Rodriguez's 2016 book, A Coyote in the Kitchen, A Memoir of New and Old Mexico, is a collection of authentic northern New Mexico recipes and stories from her life. Here's Colette LaBeouf talking with Anita Rodriguez. They begin by discussing her book, A Coyote in the Kitchen, and a recent essay from Rodriguez.
The thing that struck me about both the essay and the book and your columns, I enjoyed the column on masks today as well.
Thank you.
Is that your writing and your telling is layered. History, art, the family, language, daily life, and food. Don't forget food, right? For your narratives, though, the violence in history is a refrain. Can you talk about how, for you, as an artist and writer, you negotiate this ongoing presence of that violence?
Well, I don't think that it is that you can localize my interest in violence in me or in any of my interests or even just in Taos. You have to extend it to the entire country. We are the most violent country on the planet. We have more military bases than anybody else. We have more weapons than anybody else. We have more guns inside than anybody else. We have mass shootings more than anybody else. We have more prisoners than anybody else. We began with a history of genocide and continue with the history of slavery. Who's fighting the fires in California right now?
Right.
So, no, I don't think that it's a particular obsession of mine or even particularly relevant to Taos. It's the whole country.
It's a conversation you're continuing to address in your work, which is, it's not like it can be addressed once and go away, because it is, like you said, it's a massive ongoing issue, especially throughout the whole country.
Right. And so to ignore it is to be complicit.
And if we don't want to be complicit, how do you suggest we, anybody, begin to not be complicit?
Become activists, mm-hmm. Vote, read. Stop mm-hmm. being armchair and Facebook activists. Get involved. Mm-hmm. Get into the streets. Mm-hmm. Do something. Mm-hmm. It's apologizing isn't enough. Yeah. We need to act now.
And here we are, just a few weeks before an election. So in the essay you sent me, you talk about your career and your art in Adobe and how it began. And I'm going to quote you. You write, quote, "In 1973, I needed a job. I took a camera and tape recorder into the villages, found the Las Ñeradoras, now old, and in exchange for their tricks and secrets, gave my labor. I weeded gardens, took them shopping." This is the birth of your work for 25 years. If we think of how ways or paths can die and how your effort extended not only an art, but a history and a narrative with those layers. If you were a young person in Taos today and you wanted to learn something that you felt was going to disappear, are there still art forms or traditions one could learn this way? And what would you suggest?
I would suggest to all people that they look for their own cultural traditions and their own roots, mm-hmm. and not tread the delicate path between appreciation and appropriation. Because traditions are part of a larger whole, of a functioning cultural ecology. And like an adobe wall, if you take a tradition out of context, it's like taking a brick out of a wall. Suddenly you have destabilized the wall, and you also have nothing but a brick. It doesn't tell you anything about the building, the shape of the building, the history of the building. So if you come in from the outside and adopt a tradition that doesn't belong to your culture and that doesn't have the surrounding context of history, of lifestyle, of all of the connections that traditions have to other parts of the culture, you're actually committing an act of colonialism.
And back to that violence, in a sense.
It is an act of violence. Cultural appropriation is an act of violence.
Absolutely. So that kind of brings me to the book, which I loved.
Thank you. I loved the book.
So tell me about how you, as a writer, decided on this form for the memoir. And I mentioned to you ahead that I was just so struck by what felt, and the way I described it, was a sewn-in feeling of the recipes, really integral to the narrative, not separate, not like, here's the story, and then, oh, here's the recipes, but this true feeling of it being cohesive, which impressed me so much as a writer. So what was it like to work through and find this form? Can you talk about that process?
Well, I think that storytelling and food and cooking and sitting by the campfire are old, 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 deeply engraved in our oldest memories. So it was kind of a natural choice. And a family's recipes are the history of a family, of their religion, of their migrations, you know, of who intermarried, of where they lived, of the climate and the available foods and materials. So recipes say a lot about who we are. So that was also a way of sewing together all of these stories. And so I used food like a thread to sew together all of these different stories, because food is universal, primordial, and has so much meaning. Only 5% of the early diet was actually meat. The other 95% came from gathering and the cooking of food. And that 95% made available so many more nutrients and minerals that it developed the frontal cortex. So the connection between women, recipes, and cooking was something I wanted people to think about.
Is there a favorite recipe for you from the book? I'm curious.
Well, I like the tamale recipe is really great. I mean, I really think that the tamale, and then there are combinations, like there is the salmon with apricot fruit, and then there's a recipe for salmon, grape salsa, and avocado soup. And they're a really good combination. I mean, I'm a painter, so I like the color combination. And the tastes are really great. Those they're kind of like my two favorites.
I'm going to skip ahead here, but one of the things that really struck me, and I mentioned this to you, was that for a newcomer to Taos, you know, I've only been here for 2.5 years. I really enjoyed that you wrote, quote, "A person doesn't exist in Taos without an identifying family. Until you have lived here for at least 2 generations, you are transparent." Do you think Taos also draws people here who want to disappear because of this? And what about those of us, or any of us who are here who are new? Is there a space to participate?
Well, when I reflect upon having said that, you know, I can see that it might attract criticisms that it's a racist statement, because it's a way of saying, I don't see you. You know, you're transparent. It's a way of saying, I don't see color. But then on the other hand, I think that it is probably a universal attitude among Indigenous people or people who have lived on the same land for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then I don't care where migrants go, and I don't care what class they are. They're never welcome. Mm-hmm. And migrants always bring with them their culture, because we cherish our cultures. So wherever they go, they cluster together in groups where they can share their language, their food, their holidays, and things of that nature. So all of these are basic human tendencies. Mm-hmm. I think when trouble arises from these situations is where there's injustice and inequality. Mm-hmm. Not the fact that there are cultures or even that there are migrations.
That kind of leads me to another passage that really struck me, which is early on in the book. Quote, stories of trauma and atrocity are passed on from one generation to the next, sometimes even without words, erecting invisible barriers of secrecy, dividing old enemies, and perpetuating resentments, even when the original causes have been forgotten. But with this darkness also came a brave spirit of resistance that has marked the history of this valley with a love of independence for its own sake, end quote. And that made me think, is this a Taos story that you're telling, or is this Taos more than any other places, or do other places experience this, what you're talking about? And what makes that true in those other places?
Well, I think that places, that's a hard question. Mm-hmm. Taos really does have a universal uniqueness. Mm-hmm. It's a metaphor for every place where there has been cultural conflict and confluence. Mm-hmm. And we've had a long time to incubate our historical experience here. Native people and Hispanic people have been neighbors on this land now for about 500 years. And in spite of all of the conflicts and the bloodshed and the injustice and the atrocities, we have developed a kind of overlapping but separate cultures. And the areas where we overlap, we have developed traditions that are really worthy, I think, of being studied on a global basis, like the Acequia system.
Okay, I was going to ask you specifically. Yeah.
Or our architecture, which okay. is sustainable, built out of free materials, and is criticized by the construction industry, which is based on profit and the sale of labor, is criticized because it melts. Now close your eyes and visualize Taos Pueblo. Let that sink in. That building or parts of it are 1,000 years old. So we developed an architectural style that has the characteristics that the building materials of the future need to have: ecological sustainability, and they're outside the cash economy, because with collective labor and the use of naturally available materials, we provided ourselves with housing. No mm-hmm. banks, no mortgage, mm-hmm. very few outside materials. Mm-hmm. Now that's big.
That was Anita Rodriguez talking with Colette LaBeouf. Let's take a break. When we come back, more from Anita Rodriguez about the local cultures of Taos. Thank you. Welcome back to the TCA Radio Hour. I'm Crystal. Anita Rodriguez was an adobe plasterer at the age of 30, a painter at 47, and at 75, she wrote and illustrated Coyote in the Kitchen, a memoir of New and Old Mexico. Here's Rodriguez talking about how and why the traditions and local cultures of Taos draw visitors and transplants here.
So there's water, then there's housing, and then there's agriculture. Mm-hmm. Here we have a third living body of knowledge that is incredibly valuable, and that is how to farm on this land. 1,000 years of continuous accumulated practical empirical know-how. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what attracts people here. Mm-hmm. The traditions, they're kind of like the makeup, mm-hmm. but the skeletal structure are cultures in which the priority is the community, mm-hmm. not the individual. It's not my personal right to wear a mask or own a gun that's important and that will gain me prestige and respect in these two old local cultures. What will gain me respect in these two local cultures is how much of myself I give to my communities. Not what my rights are, but what my obligations are, mm-hmm. to nature, to my family, and to my community. And that is, I think, what attracts people here, is that people are refugees from capitalism, which is based on selfishness.
And that taking, you're talking about the assertion of rights as opposed to an offering of participation.
It's my right to come into your culture and take one of your traditions. I'm light-skinned, you know, let's say I have a degree, let's say I have connections, let's say I have published. So I can take a tradition out of your culture, completely out of its context, and no doubt get it wrong and commercialize it, and the original source won't make a dime. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is that same spirit of appropriation.
And you talk about that in when you talk about when you went into business writing the book and the proposal kind of being nothing happening with the proposal right away, right? And that I can't remember who the other writer was, but that you saw some other publication that got kind of snatched up. And I thought that was so interesting, because as the story of your work with Adobe, that it becomes a woman's story also. And yep. that's sort of another layer to this.
Right.
And that leads me to talking about, this was it your grandfather, El
Viejo Atole? Well, yeah, that's kind of like a paraphrase of what his real name was.
Yeah, a nickname.
Yeah, great, 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 great grandfather.
Okay. That he had, in talking about him, you mentioned that he had five wives, and there's some question about what happened to those women or who they were, right? But you write, the quote, "the deaths of women are often erased and not just in Taos," end quote. So tell me more about that. Women.
Well, the greatest single cause of death amongst women is domestic violence. Now, how many people know that? Mm-hmm. And just think about it. The single biggest cause of death. It kills more women than automobile accidents, cancer, and heart disease combined. Mm-hmm. And that's so erased, yes, that we just take it for granted.
Yes.
We keep all the rape kits forever. Nobody cares. You know, they say, oh, what did she do? How, she must have asked for it. Maybe she likes it.
Mm-hmm. That history, yes.
And at the Senior Citizen mm-hmm. Center, a very old person told me that my great-great-great-great-grandfather poisoned all those women.
Yes, yes. And you kind of refer to that in the book. But why? I mean, because it was possible.
Well, yeah.
Right?
if as many women die today from domestic violence as there do, of course the lives of women are worthless.
Mm-hmm. So we talk about these maternal and paternal influences in your book. And I really like the way your book kind of negotiates those, kind of moves back and forth exploring what that history was like, your mother's side of the family and your father's side, and also explores as you were young, you know, what as young individuals we're allowed to know or to understand or to talk about. And there's that scene in the book where in learning about murder because of race, your mother tells you, and I won't get the Southern accent right, but quote, "We never talk about those things," end quote. And then takes you to see the peacocks. And I love that scene. I love that scene because it's this shutting down, this, you know, knowing about something violent and awful, and then putting in front of you this beautiful thing, which I also connect to your color and your art and your this vibrancy. So that sort of collision of worlds. Do you feel these influences are still at work in your art and life, these stories that are so formative, these illustrations?
I think so. I think that even though it happened in the recent past of my childhood, those things are still happening. People are still nostalgic about their monuments and how they remember sitting under them when they were young and reading poetry or something. And yet, only, 79 years ago, Emmett Till was murdered, and his murderers were never brought to justice. And how long has it been since Breonna Taylor was killed? And her murderers have not been brought to justice. So this is like Faulkner says, the past isn't about the past. It isn't even past. Mm-hmm. It's still happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are you a Faulkner fan? I'm interested to know.
Oh, well, you know, I'm not blind to the racism implicit in,
sure.
In almost all literature in English. For instance, in all English literature, unless the character is other than white, their race is never mentioned. So white is the default setting for all characters in English American literature. If the character is Black, Native American, or Hispanic, something has to be said to point that out. If nothing is said, everybody knows that it's the default setting. Mm-hmm. So what was your original question? I digressed there.
I just wondered if, despite all of this, and yes, the truth of what you're saying, if you were a Faulkner reader, or, I mean, I know that people, I'm not a Faulkner fan, but I know some people are, even despite all this, or to learn something from it. So I was curious, because I know you're also a poet.
His language is incredible. You know, and Willa Cather's novel, Death Comes to the Archbishop, you could redline that from racist comments, but you can't take away from her that she really writes well.
Mm-hmm.
And Picasso was like a brutal misogynist.
Yes.
But you can't take away his talent.
Mm-hmm. It makes me, I mean, I know this is an ongoing conversation about, you know, the art and the person, right? I mean, it's ongoing. It's still happening in museums today and in publications. It's ongoing. You know, do we turn aside from the work because of the person? It's interesting. I think that
kind of like the monuments.
It is.
You know what they're doing in Mexico? They're putting up anti-monumentos. You know, instead of throwing down monuments, they're putting up other ones. I can't remember where it was, but it's a beautiful kind of abstract sculpture that is both the sign of Venus and the sign of women against the feminicides.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like it would be like maybe putting up a statue alongside the statue of Oñate that tells the truth,
mm-hmm.
or building monuments that deepen and broaden the history. Yeah, and I agree that throwing them down is important, and I'm for it, and I think it should be done. But I hope it doesn't turn into another form of erasure.
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting what you're talking about. If wherever that's being done, the idea that there could be a conversation established,
right?
That there could be an opening about why one exists and why the other does.
Monument, public art that discloses the truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just the
mm-hmm.
truth.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about monuments. I'm going to shift a little bit and kind of go back to the mud. Because women in the history of churches in New Mexico and mud, you talk about their importance in the book. And this was teaching by oral tradition. And I'm curious. I'm always curious about how oral tradition still matters in this world today, and what your take on that is. You know, we started out talking, yeah, we learn things from our family. Our families tell us stories or what to do, but how much of that is left?
Well, I think it's so organic. It's almost like culture itself, which is like maybe the shells that mollusks or oysters create as an interface with their natural environment. Mm-hmm. I think that we kind of like exude these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a natural impulse. And I think that storytelling is the original form of history. It's the original carrier of all knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so the storytelling voice has the power of music. It affects the body. It comes out of the body. So stories might morph and they can become lies, but they will always be powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And lies are always really revealing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and I talked about this with you about my experience of reading the book that I really, I found compelling as you tell it, is the role of witchery as the book goes on, and the feeling for me that it deepens in the narrative. You know, also as the family grows, as you grow older and you're able to see the family differently, your mother and your relatives, these stories about sickness and envy, truth and difficulty, and food, and it just keeps, you know, it stays there. How does food figure into our most difficult experiences? And I'm thinking, actually, when I say that about the beginning of your book with the beans and your mother, and that just amazing illustration of the drama of the family, right? But also nourishment and how we are formed.
Well, we can't live without food. It's like water.
And yet that's a story that is about you finding the beans on the ceiling, right?
Right.
You know, so it's like, but you're fed also by this, you're fed by these just around the food as well.
Well, food has meat. For instance, in catastrophes, mm-hmm. you know, in catastrophes, what happens? The women go to the kitchen.
Yeah.
The further north you come in New Mexico, the bigger our funeral feasts are, the more food we eat. that's the there's a book by Ashley Montague called The Biological Superiority of Women. And it's an analysis of the way women collectively actually respond to catastrophes, like the bombing of Belsen, the burning of Belsen, the bombing of London, and I think an earthquake in China. But, you know, what he discovered is that the first thing women do is, okay, where's the food, the water? You take care of the babies, the old people go over there, you know, immediately. Somebody builds a shelter over where they're going to serve the food. Mm-hmm. We have breasts. Mm-hmm. Our breasts have been degraded into symbols for the satisfaction of playthings of patriarchy. But they are the primordial symbol for the giving and nourishment of life. They are the first food. And so when you talk about women and food and cooking and the development of the frontal cortex and comfort and the transmission of history and oral traditions, it all fits together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's part of a bigger picture.
It's part of a bigger picture about women, the history of women. I mean, what is the source of all wealth? The womb. So patriarchy has really done us a number.
To say the least.
Let's take a break. And when we're back, more from Anita Rodriguez.
We are listening today to Brooklyn musician Missa. The songs on air are some of her first releases, carrying a message of hope and inviting her listeners to view the world with wonder and curiosity. We're listening now to Overturning Buses.
Metate Mano, 728,000 BC, forged in the crucible of a volcano's maw, spat out bone of earth's entrails, ice cracked, wind swept, rain washed, glacier ground, I fell, already wise and broke to fit a hand. I know songs for corn grinding, rain calling, berry picking, and trout fishing. A song about a river where branches burdened with choke cherries bend to bathe their red ripeness in a silent pool among sleeping trout. Her waiting hand, crimson with coal, slowly closed, a sudden flashing, twisting silver muscle, splashing, gasping, flapping, stopped, slapped on the stone. A song that tells how, stuffed with river mint, wrapped in willow bark, baked under coals, that fish sacrificed itself to her hand. I know a song about looking for mushrooms in the mountains. In that song, mushrooms only fill hands wise enough to wait for the full moon. They grow in a village where only aspen trees live, their roots talking in their silent language under deep grass. Overhead, the canopy of glowing yellow leaves blazing with summer's final fires sing in that whispery accent of the aspen tree tribe that sounds like falling rain or shaking gourds. and between the cadmium roof and the bright green floor, your eye will get lost among hundreds and hundreds of tall, thin, buckskin gray aspen tree people all talking at once. I know bone-building roots, life-saving medicines. Trementina, blood of the pine, will seal the edges of a wound overnight and drain an abscess tooth, while garlic, crushed and tied to the feet, will save a dying baby. Yerba buena strengthens the heart. Quelites make the bones strong. Yerba de la negrita makes hair grow. And alucema clears the lungs. If you drink malva tea and eat nopales, you will never go blind. I know flavors, spices, and mother perfect tastes. Oregano de la Sierra makes perfect tamales. Verdolagas are good with eggs. Pululu plums are sweet, but tunas are even sweeter. And if you dry green chile, it gets hotter. And squash blossoms, tortillas, and tamales can be stuffed with anything. I learned songs from mother hens, grandmother hens, great-grandmother hens, who warmed my dark, dense, abandoned, volcano-born, woman-wise stone heart with their hands. I call it metate mano. Corn is ground on a table that is called a metate, that is made out of volcanic rock. And the part that is held by hand is used to crush the kernels and is moved back and forth against the table of the volcanic rock to grind the corn. And that part is called the mano. And mano means hand in Spanish.
Welcome back to the TCA Radio Hour. I'm Crystal. That was Anita Rodriguez reading for us. At the age of 47, Rodriguez retired her contractor's license and became a full-time painter. In 1996, she rented out her self-built adobe house in Taos and moved to Guanajuato, Mexico for 15 years and then eventually returned to Taos. Rodriguez says that she wants to create paintings accessible to people of different cultures, levels of education, and class. She uses skeletons because they cross all class, cultural, and gender lines and notes that everybody gets death. Her paintings possess layers of meaning, animals, symbols, messages, and mystery. She says, quote, "There's plenty of intellectual chew toys for the Jungians and references to literature and folklore in two languages. But the messages I'm interested in transcend class, age, culture, and gender," end quote. Here's Colette LaBeouf talking with Anita Rodriguez.
I know you're very busy. And I know you're involved in a lot of things that are really crucial. And I know that you continue to make. What are you making? What are you painting? What are you writing? Tell me about that.
Well, right now I've got this thing. It's like works sort of start, sometimes take years to bubble up to the surface, and they come in pieces and fragments, and I have to wait until it all sifts together. But there's a story that I have already written fragments of that is kind of like a love story of reincarnated couples that transgender back and forth between men and women throughout history and enact out the cultural conflicts of the place that I love the most and where I was born. So these will be characters, and it has to be in poetic form.
In poetic form, in poetry, not in prose.
No, it will be in poetry, and may have prose sections, and it will be illustrated too. I will illustrate it with black and white drawings. And the whole story will be told in the voices of objects, like an arrowhead, a metate, and walls, buildings that remember what happened inside of them, and whose foundations are much older than the part you can see.
So I'm going to just go back a little bit. You started out saying sometimes these things come in fragments, and so this is about process. I'm interested in your process as a writer. When you talk about how long these things take, I mean, this idea you have, how long has it been sort of percolating or in your mind to be like, this is going to be something at some point?
Well, I used to think that all this stuff was in my head, all these ideas and these images and these stories and all this stuff. And then I began to get older, and now I realize that I have holes in my head. And through the holes in my head, I can take a peek out into a reality that's way bigger than my head. Right? And so I have learned to trust my talent. And this is really good advice for young artists, whether you're writers or poets or painters, is trust your talent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Honor your talent. Mm-hmm. When I get stuck on a painting, I could make myself sick. I mean, I have paintings that I got sick because I couldn't figure out, oh God, it's just like, I can't paint anymore. I'll never paint again. It was all fake. You know? And other artists tell me the same thing. They go through these agonizing blocks. And writers do too, as you can't write. But if you trust yourself and you just have the patience to wait, it'll say, I need blue. Or like a character of Unamuno's. Mm-hmm. In one of his novels, I can't remember which one, is it? The writer decides he wants to talk to his character, so he gets in the car and he drives to where the character lives because he knows the road very well. He described it, and he drives into the character's house and he knocks on the door. He gets into a conversation with the character, and the character says, why did you make me say that? I wouldn't say anything that stupid. You know, so you trust your characters. Mm-hmm. You put them in situations that reveal who they really are. You torture them. Mm-hmm. So you can see what they're made of. Mm-hmm. And you get stuck on a poem and you say, okay, I'll work on the painting for a while, or I'll take a walk.
That's what I was going to ask you, actually, is I was curious about, do you, if you feel at an impasse or at a pause with writing, do you go to painting or vice versa?
Because yes.
How lucky to have those two things.
Well, you know, and then there's cooking.
Okay.
You know,
absolutely, I agree with the cooking. That's a whole other way to make space.
And it's another way to be creative. And once again, it's trust your style. I don't know why, but I knew it needed cinnamon.
Interesting.
So it's I don't know. It's like creativity comes from a source that is just bottomless. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started to paint, it was 1989, December the 24th, is when I decided to become a professional painter. I had to spend Christmas by myself. And I decided, well, you know, if I don't do it now, I never will. And so I found some pencils that my daughter had left behind when she left and went to college. And I started drawings, and I did a series of drawings that eventually a year later ended up becoming my first show. But in the process of doing it, I exhausted myself because I was so happy. It was so much fun. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to go to the bathroom. I just wanted to keep working on the drawing. And finally, I threw myself on the bed in a state of exhaustion. And I had a movie epiphany of years of work roll through my head. So there's this endless supply of images and words and metaphors and music somewhere.
Were you already writing when you decided to be a painter? Did writing come first for you?
Well, storytelling was part of the culture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was like oral writing. Yeah, you know, there were stories. And so when I started school and was asked by a teacher to write a story, I wrote down something that I had overheard. Mm-hmm. And they thought, oh, wow, how wonderful. And I thought, okay, that's what I'll do.
Interesting.
And my mother was an artist, so you know, I played with her stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you talk about that in the book, I think, right? She was supportive of you that way and encouraging of the art.
Yes. And besides, if she gave materials to me, I'd go away and leave her alone.
Are there other art forms you work with right now at this point in your life besides the painting and the writing? And the cooking? Are there other forms that you explore? I just feel like you do so much. There must be more. I have this feeling.
Well, my bedroom, for instance, is filled with costumes that I created, really elaborate, you know, costumes. And I was interested in that for a while. I used to make all my own clothes and my daughter's clothes and my husband's clothes, you know, so I liked that. I liked the, you know, fabric art. And then I worked with clay. I don't do any of these things anymore because I don't have the room and, you know, like I need a new body to be able to, you know, do all these things. But, you know, like any material, that could be used to make art ever since I was a little girl, I don't know, it just turned out that way.
Mm-hmm. 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 It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Anita, about all this stuff. I love your book and I am curious. I mean, I don't want to end on a negative note because one of the questions I asked you was about 2020, this year we are experiencing. And I mean, especially because of the pandemic, I mean, I'm just wondering, what is this in terms of artists and in terms of people making? What do you say about people making during this pandemic? Or do you have any advice for artists who are trying to find a way to be creative in what might be a scary time for some people? What might be a time where they're afforded more time? I don't know. I'm not sure what the experience is, but I know that it feels very uneasy, this time we're in, for a lot of people.
Well, artists, you know, you talk about creativity. This is the time when the entire planet has an opportunity to creatively reset the entire civilization. No, I take that back. This is a time when we have no other choice because everything is caving in. It's not just, you know, the restaurants or the schools. It's Boeing and Amazon and, you know, all of it. The government, the electoral system, none of it works. Mm-hmm. So this is the time when creativity is going to come out of our bones, and we need artists more than we've ever needed them. Mm-hmm. If this is the time when we need to think out of the box, mm-hmm. This is it. This is the time when we need to teach our children creativity and when we need to be as creative as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. So this is like, I think this will surge through the zeitgeist and creative people will just gush creativity in the same way that we perspire. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's for the collective survival of the human race. And I think art is necessary for that purpose.
I agree. Anita, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. And your questions are so good.
That was Anita Rodriguez talking with Colette LaBeouf. Anita Rodriguez's work is currently on view in the Harwood Museum's Contemporary Art Taos 2020 exhibition. The TCA Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, Taos Opera Guild, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetaosradio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thanks so much for tuning in. Say